Hello and good morning. This is Emily Austin from the Episcopal Church in West Tennessee, and you are listening to Faithfully Memphis. Each week we have the opportunity to come into the studio at our crosstown radio home, WYXR, and talk to people whose faith is buzzing in the background of their lives, and they're expressing it in a variety of interesting ways. And this week, I am really, really excited to have with me in the studio my friend and colleague from Church of the Holy Communion in Memphis, Dr. David Utz. Hey, David.
Hey, Emily. How are you?
I am doing really well because I don't get to see you very often, but I get you for a whole morning today. And we get to talk about music and art and expression and the way that, you know, how all of these trappings of beauty can be used in the liturgy. You're like my go-to person for that.
Well, this is like old times because we used to talk in the office about these things all the time.
We did. We did. When I was on staff at Church of the Holy Communion, when I was working in their communications office, I remember occasionally our roles, your role as the director of music, minister of music, and, you know, all things liturgy, and my role as the communications person, we would collide. And whenever we would have like a little thing that we need to discuss, like, okay, well, maybe it's like printing service leaflets or whatever, it would just unfold into a larger, much more like beautiful conversation around art and music and the liturgy and how everything that we do in the liturgy is so intentional. And we would just kind of hang out and celebrate that together.
Well, what I do, the word has to be communicated by what you do to get the word out there. So with the music and communications in church work really do collide and collaborate.
It's music and lyrics sometimes, isn't it? So, David, for those who may not know you, I want to introduce your role. You've been at Church of the Holy Communion since, is it 2001 or 2002?
I was hired in December of 2001 and showed up in January of 2002.
Gotcha. So you've been at Church of the Holy Communion serving as the Minister of Music and Liturgy, and in that role, you're the one playing the organ, but you're also the person who's working with clergy to create those or to curate the elements of the liturgy. You direct the handbell choir. You direct the parish choir, who are singing every single week. And it's not just singing. There's so much education that goes into that. And you, at the end of the day, you are an educator, I think.
It's interesting that you say that, because I started out in life wanting to be a teacher.
Isn't it funny how we end up doing the things that we think that we're going to do?
I had a professor in grad school that said, every time you stand up in front of your choir, you're teaching.
Yeah.
And so it's like those two worlds wired together for me.
Yeah. And you're originally from South Carolina. I think that...
Yes.
I love that we can hear that in your accent.
Well, I've lived kind of all over the eastern half of the country, and I've never lost it, so.
I love that. So let's just talk at the very beginning. Let's go back to the very beginning. And, I mean, I know you as a person. You're a friend and you're a colleague. You're a person who is so passionate, and you love the art and the music. It is something that you speak to with such knowledge, but that kind of loving knowledge. And that's why I think you're a teacher, is that you have such care for the things, for the music, and for the way that the liturgy can unfold in any context, but especially in a church context. how did that all start? How did that all start, even from your early life? Has faith and music always been there?
It really has. Growing up in South Carolina, going to church as a child was not an option.
Yeah.
We went to church. My father sang in his church choir from the time he was 12 years old on. Mm-hmm. And I watched my father bring choir music home to practice by himself at our piano. Mm-hmm. So I knew he was that committed and dedicated to it. And one of my first memories is from age 4. I used to sit in the choir loft. They would have to come get me mm-hmm. to take me home. I would sit in the floor in the choir loft and watch the organist play the postlude after the service with her hands and her feet on the organ. And I was fascinated by that. So then I wanted to play the organ. Mm-hmm. But I was told as a young child that you had to have years of piano study first.
You continue, and then I have a question after that. Yeah, go ahead.
That was a bitter pill to swallow.
Yeah.
But one of the measuring sticks of when you're ready to study the organ is, can you play Bach's 2- and 3-part inventions?
What does that mean? I don't even know what
they
that
are,
is.
They are technically busy.
Yeah.
Piano pieces.
Mm-hmm.
A little kid has to work on dexterity and, you know, with hands, because little kid's hands are not like an elementary school child's hands. And the other thing is, it doesn't really make sense for a 6-year-old to take organ lessons because you can't reach the foot pedals.
Right. Yeah. There's like an actual, they don't make child size pianos.
No,
I don't think, right?
No, or organs. And so it's better to have this solid foundation of piano until you grow into your teenage years and then are physically able to sit at an organ and play the keyboards and the feet at the same time. And then you progress faster.
What I was going to ask is, now in your adulthood, do you think that are you glad that you got put through those piano paces? And it sounds like you were. It's foundational to if you're aspiring to be an organist.
The minister of music at my home church, I think, saw something in me early on.
Mm-hmm.
And she was my piano teacher. So I always felt like she was pushing me a little more or in a different direction, because she saw something in me early on, and, mm-hmm. and I'm really thankful for her. I knew I had to have that solid piano background, and but then by the time I reached junior high school, I was able to take organ lessons, and then I really felt like I took off.
Yeah, when you're a young person who is inspired and just fascinated by an instrument like the organ, and you may not necessarily have, at least for myself, when I was a kid, you know, you grab onto to pieces of the culture and pieces of media, and you like kind of entrench yourself in them. For me, it was the Titanic. I don't know why. This was long before the movie came out, but I loved it. And so I wonder, it sounds like initially it was the fascination with the organ for you, but now you are an expert on classical music, liturgical music. When did that become like an addendum to this world of music that you would commit your life to?
Well, if I'm any, you know, facet of an expert, I'm only passing along information that I have learned, that I've been privileged to learn, sitting at the feet of teachers and professors. And this is where the long lineage of music happens. I mean, you know, there have been composers through the ages, and the composers that we revere today had their own mentors that pushed them through as well. So, I loved church so much, but I also loved school.
Yeah.
And so I started out life because I didn't know any full-time church musicians. I didn't know you could make a living.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's probably a, I don't know. I know you're from South Carolina, but I don't know if it was a
very small town in South Carolina.
You're not just going to like run into somebody and say, and if you have a niche interest and have like a large cohort of people who you can hang out with and be like, okay, let's talk about Bach today, or let's talk about, you know, these like specific things that are, you know, challenges to being an organist. It seems like you have to kind of like branch out.
Well, in my little hometown, there were only part-time church musicians, choir directors, and organists, and you did something else during the week. And when I was a teenager, I started going to youth music workshops and youth music camps, and I started meeting adults who were full-time career musicians in larger towns in South Carolina. And so when I figured out that I could make a full-time living with the right experience as a full-time church musician, that was it for me.
Yeah.
It was like all my worlds collided at that moment.
Yeah. And you could do it.
I could do it. And that's what I love to do. The real goal or privilege, I guess, in life for all of us is trying to find our vocation, what feeds the world and what feeds us. And that's when the heavens and the earth wire together. And I just was lucky enough to have people around me that exposed me to all of that and pushed me in that direction. And by the time I went to college, I knew exactly what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about vocation, especially as, you know, you and I are both lay people who are, and we're passionate about church. We're just passionate about worship and what it can be. How has that played out in your own kind of spiritual, like your own personal spirituality throughout your life?
I've always had a hard time separating work and what I do and who I am.
I relate to that.
You know, some people say, oh, church music is what you do. That's not true. Church music is who I am. And so I have to work hard to make myself not do church music all the time.
Yeah.
I have to work hard to try to leave my work at the church and go home and do other things, you know.
Yeah.
But that's a privilege as well. And vocation, I think, can be anything.
Yeah.
We've installed a new organ console recently at the church, and I've been working with a team of four electricians. And I watch what they do, running wires through the ceiling and coming out at the back of the organ console. And they do that with the same precision that I play preludes and postludes with.
Yeah.
And so everybody has their own vocation. And the real blessing, I think, in life is to search for that, to try to find that, to let people help you find that.
Yeah, because it's there. I believe, too, that it's there for everyone. And it's hard to find it in isolation. It's hard to locate what it. I think that sometimes we have within each of us as individuals a yearning, but sometimes it's hard to find the language. It's like you can see what you can be and who you are and what feeds you, but we have to be in community to find the language and the people who can drive us to who we are meant to be and to live out those vocational kind of life aspirations and live into the people and be the people who God really wants us to be. We have to do it in community.
Right. Well, no man is an island.
Right.
And the church is one of those vehicles or venues that we have in the world that helps us find community and stay in community.
Well, that's I feel like this is a good opportunity for us to talk about the glory of a choir. And, you know, we were speaking earlier about how you thought for a while you know, maybe in your younger years, maybe like teaching was going to be a thing you did. And now you are teaching, but it's within the context of leading a parish choir and leading, you know, a handbell choir and working also on a church team. A church at its best is a living, breathing organization or organism that has many, many vital parts, and those parts are its people. And I feel like the musical and you as a staff member, but also as a, you know, you're talking about like how it's hard to separate David the employee from David the musician, from David the Christian. Like those are all bundled together. I feel like that you are like a really good exemplar of what it means to be a part of a community. So can we talk a little bit about, like, you know, not to go too lofty, but like the choir as a symbol? Like what have you learned in your years leading this parish choir at Church of the Holy Communion, and what are the things that you take away from this multi-voiced entity that helps us to that really sings to our individual souls?
My choir takes care of themselves and could probably do choir rehearsal without me, or a good part of it, whether I'm there or not. The choir is a small group within the church. So, you know, the whole church, we have a whole membership, but then the choir is like a Sunday school class, or like the youth group, or the ladies who knit or who have our food ministry for the food insecure. We have a big ministry for that. Mm-hmm. So the choir is a small group that shows up to rehearse on Wednesday nights. And but it always amazes me how I have to stop the visiting and the recipe passing and the yarn exchanging that goes on in my choir just to do rehearsal.
Yeah.
And it shows me that they really do depend on each other. They love each other. They like checking in with each other. Mm-hmm. So that feeds them. I've had choir members to tell me before that they were tired after work, and they show up for choir at 6:30 and they go home at 8:30 and they're invigorated.
Yeah. Mm.
And so, mm-hmm. you know, that's a wonderful thing to be a part of.
'Cause we need each other.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I feel so privileged to be able to convene that group and then to stand up in front of them. And the individual voices, there are lead singers and there are follow singers in every choir.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are better music readers than others in every choir. And you put all that together and something new and wonderful and beautiful is created.
Yeah.
Every time.
Boy, and that's the truth. Y'all are singing every Sunday morning. You the parish choir, for lack of better terms, y'all are, I hate to use the word performing, but you are singing. You are adding to the liturgy at 10:30 every morning. But you're also always working on special performances and special worship opportunities where music is sort of the central point of the liturgy. And so one of those things that's coming up this weekend, do you want to talk a little bit about that 10:30 a.m. Performance that y'all are going to be doing?
Sure. It's a real privilege to be able to take a major choral work and incorporate it into your regular Sunday morning service.
Mm-hmm. And it is a choral work.
It is. It was composed as a choral work, as its own large entity. And there are a number of reasons that I want to do major choral works with the choir. It keeps them on their toes. It causes them to learn new music. It's different than just singing hymns and an anthem or two on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's an experience that choir members that didn't sing in their high school or college choir, where you might do more major works, they get to do a major work in the church choir.
Mm-hmm.
So this work that we're doing Sunday morning is the Gabriel Fauré Requiem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We're doing it at 10:30 mm-hmm. this Sunday. Last Sunday was All Saints Sunday.
Yes,
so we had All Saints Day. We had All Souls Day.
Yes.
Then we had All Saints Sunday to honor the saints, the big saints and the minor saints
right.
and the lay people saints.
Yeah, and last week on Faithfully Memphis, we and Bishop Phoebe talked quite a bit about why, like, the relevance of All Saints and those, you know, those early November remembrances that are so central to our, you know, Christian and Episcopal liturgical year and the cycle. So I would recommend that to anybody who missed that, but that was in that context.
Right.
But the Fauré Requiem, do we...
We're doing it on Remembrance Sunday.
Right, right.
Remembrance Sunday is really an English observance. The mm-hmm. churches in England observe Remembrance Sunday. It's the Sunday closest to their Armistice Day, mm-hmm. which translates to our Veterans Day.
Yes, yes.
But once again, we remember those who have gone before us in service or otherwise. So there are some Episcopal churches that have transferred the observance from England over here and, uh-huh. and observe Remembrance Sunday.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why we have put this Fauré Requiem on Sunday morning on Remembrance Sunday. And
can you talk a little bit about to the very literal lay people like me, what a Requiem is?
The Requiem Mass. Is the texts of the Mass for the burial of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
As Christians, we don't need to be afraid of the word dead.
Right.
In the South, where I grew up, the Deep South, we really didn't say someone died. We said they passed
they
on.
They passed on or passed
right.
away. Mm-hmm. Or they went to be with Jesus.
Right,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
All of that. But the Bible talks about the dead, the mm-hmm. beloved dead. We as Christians know that dying is not the end of the story.
Right.
So we don't have to be afraid of the word dead. So Requiem or translated Mass for the dead, these texts go back to the early single-digit centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And music for those texts, of course, would have been plain song chant mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. Roman tradition mm-hmm. back that far.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause we're thinking back thousands of years.
Yes,
you know. Yes.
Yes. Third century, fourth century, fifth century.
I don't think there were organs back then, right?
No,
yeah.
No.
Yeah,
no.
I didn't think so.
The only music they had was plain song chant.
Right.
Fast forward to the 18th century or so. By that time, English composers for the Church of England, Henry Purcell, Orlando Gibbons, were composing Requiem Masses mm-hmm. that were more intricate and were sung by choirs.
Mm-hmm.
Then fast forward into the 19th century, and composers started writing, well, in late 18th century, composers started writing large-scale Requiem Masses. These were not always adaptable or even intended for performance in a church service.
Mm-hmm.
They were concert pieces that would have been had sung in a concert hall. So Mozart's Requiem would be really difficult, and you'd have to leave out parts of it.
Right, right.
To wedge that into a right. regular worship service.
Right, right.
But composers all through, Dvorak, Berlioz, Saint-Saëns, Fauré in the late 1800s, in the 20th century, Dirofle, even composers today. I have a brand new Requiem that I didn't even know about by a North Carolina composer, Dan Locklear,
yeah.
who's very well known in church music circles, that I'm going to look at.
Yeah. And that's what's amazing to me is that this is not old. We're not just performing and singing music that is ancient, although we could be. This is a living, breathing art form where there are new works and innovation. It sounds like innovation that is made by composers and musicians who are living today, and that's fascinating to me, and it is very heartening to me that like these that this kind of sacred music is not relegated to the history books.
Well, it's the texts that have stood the test of time.
Right.
At choir last night, when we rehearsed the last movement of the Fauré Requiem, which is the In Paradisum, may choirs of angels lead you to your final rest, we just all decided that's the way we want to go.
Yeah.
To those comforting words. And as I said, you know, we leave this earth and we go to be with God in another existence. And I'm fascinated too by how these ancient texts haven't changed. The music has changed. The music style has changed all through the centuries, but the texts are still the same.
That is one of my favorite things, and a thing that I take a lot of comfort in. This is going to sound like a commercial for the Episcopal Church, but guess what? You're listening to the podcast from the Episcopal Church, so whatever. Like, that's one of my favorite things about what we do, is that these liturgies they're old. They change. We're going to have a general convention next year, and in that context, you know, like, sometimes changes are made, but these liturgies are not, changes do not come at the drop of a hat. People don't just decide to, well, we're going to include this and not include that. And that's actually a big part of the other shoe that you wear at Church of the Holy Communion and in your work there, is that you are you're the liturgist. We talk on Faithfully Memphis to a fair degree about, you know, our liturgy and the way that we worship and how we are praying, and a lot of our the frame of our worship comes from different liturgies within the Book of Common Prayer. But there are pieces that can be that are, you could change out a hymn or you can change out a prayer. And that is part of what you do at Church of the Holy Communion. Do you want to talk a little bit about what it means to be a layperson who works with, you know, ordained clergy in creating these liturgies, and how nothing is everything. Let me take that back. Everything is intentional. There are very few accidents.
Right. In the Episcopal Church, you don't do anything in our worship style that is not dictated and blessed by the bishop and by the priests at the church. I'm fortunate in that I have been given the music and the liturgy hat, and so I am affectionately patted on the head by the rector, who is the senior priest, and then I'm to go away and make sure it's all done correctly.
Yeah, and you do.
I take that as a command and a privilege. Every Sunday, we have three distinct worship opportunities. Our 8 o'clock service is the right one, which is the Elizabethan language. That has not changed since, you know, the days of Henry VIII.
That's right. And if anybody goes to a Episcopal church that is offering a right one liturgy, it's going to be kind of a blast from the past.
Well,
it can be.
But the language is so beautiful.
It is.
It's
all the
these and the thous.
Yes.
It's just so reverent.
Yes.
It's like when we address God, we're being reverent and careful. Our 10:30 service is the more contemporary style. So that's our right two. And that's where the choir sings. And that's where, you know, a lot of the big things that happen at the 10:30 service. But that's not thee and thou. It's you and yours. So there's a more familial addressing of God just by the language.
Yes.
Format does not change, but the language has changed and the style has changed. And then our 5:30 service, I mean, you walk into our 5:30 service and it's all banks of votive candles and a guitarist or a harpist and a flutist or a violinist, and the music style is very relaxed. Mm-hmm. It's either folk music, Appalachian music, or Celtic music, or Taizé chants from the monastery in France.
Right. That was actually the first taste I ever, except for a funeral that I think that I went to at Holy Communion when I was a kid. Did not grow up. Longtime listeners of Faithful Memphis will know that I did not grow up in the Episcopal Church, but
I didn't either.
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah, you and I have that in common.
I grew up Methodist. You grew up Presbyterian, mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes, and the first time I was ever in my adult life that I went to an Episcopal worship was that 5:30 at Church of the Holy Communion, and I think I was in college, and I was like, this is just, it's beautiful. I think they were doing Taizé this was many years ago, but it's so pared back, mm-hmm. and
contemplative and reflective. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's how we bill it.
Yes, exactly.
And the music that we choose for that service is contemplative and reflective. We break out of the box a little bit with some Celtic reels and jigs and things, mm-hmm. at the end of the service. But once again, the format hasn't changed. You still hear scripture. You still hear opening prayers, communion. The acts of the Last Supper are reenacted exactly as they are on Sunday morning. It's just with different language and a different setup.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to be able to offer that in one church, in one parish, you know, three distinctive worship opportunities, and to make sure that we do them right,
mm-hmm.
is just a real privilege and honor to do.
Yeah.
And I kind of ride herd on all of that just to make sure it's all done. And so I have to choose the right music. I have to hire the right musicians for the 5:30 service. I have to teach the choir their music.
Mm-hmm.
And, then it all comes together. And so, once again, there's my vocation on a platter.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just what I do every week. It's the rhythm of my life and my work.
Mm. Well, shall we listen to some music real quick?
Sure.
All right. Let's listen to, you pointed out this specific passage from the Fare Requiem. And tell me again, the performance.
It's the Cambridge Singers.
Okay.
Which is the group that John Rutter founded in England years ago. We all have our favorite movements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We were talking about that at choir last night, but mm-hmm. this one strikes me because of the text, Agnus Dei, O Lamb of God, that takes away the sins of the world, have mercy on us,
mm-hmm.
which is a pretty penitential text.
Yeah, yeah. And penitential, when we say that, we mean this is the part where we're down on our knees.
Right, right.
We are overwhelmed at the just the largeness of the grace of God and how much we need it.
So the text is penitential, but the music that Fare sets it to is transporting. It's this soaring melody. And so from the moment this movement starts, there's the dichotomy there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the penitential and the gorgeous and sublime and uplifting. And mm-hmm. all of that, I think, in the Christian experience is what we experience.
Well, we're going to listen to a little bit of it, and not the whole piece. You'll have to come
sure.
to Holy Communion on Sunday morning to hear it, but let's listen.
Church House Memphis Plan continues its decades-long commitment to serving local musicians with comprehensive health care and also tailors its focus to small business owners and the self-employed. Health care through the Memphis Plan provides care in Memphis for Memphians. Related services include preventative health, optometry, dental care, and more. More information regarding availability at memphisplan.org or at 901-272-PLAN.
And we're back. This is Faithfully Memphis, and this is Emily Austin with Dr. David Utz, who is the music guru at Church of the Holy Communion in Memphis. And we just listened to a piece from the Fare Requiem, and I think that we also got a little taste of a YouTube ad in there at some point, but we'll definitely, I'll put the link to that performance that we just listened to, the piece from the performance we just listened to, in the show notes for the podcast, so you can listen to it sans ads, or maybe you'll get the ads on YouTube. I don't know. I don't know how to escape those. But the Church of the Holy Communion, the parish choir is going to be performing the Fare Requiem as part of the 10:30 service this coming Sunday.
This Sunday. And we are being joined by the Rhodes Camerata, which is the former women's chorus.
Yeah.
This is a return opportunity for them. They have joined with us many times. Their director, Dr. Ellen Kosiel, used to be work on the music staff with me at Holy Communion. And then we are also having a chamber orchestra and accompanied by organ as well. So the chamber orchestra are all players from the Memphis Symphony.
Yeah.
And the organist is Elizabeth Smith, who during the day sells music to the church music world. Mm-hmm. I order lots of music from Elizabeth Smith in Nashville at Lewis Fife Music. But she is also a very accomplished organist, former accompanist of the Nashville Symphony Chorus.
Wow.
And so all of this is happening Sunday morning at 10:30.
And regularly happens at a lot of our churches. We bring in Holy Communion, and many, many churches, Episcopal churches in our diocese, bring in world-class musicians performing these beautiful, really spiritually important pieces that I think help us to touch, that they touch our humanity a little bit and help us see beyond the veil, and regularly here in Memphis, and always for free.
Right. Whether it's in the context of a worship service or another afternoon or night of the week, our Episcopal Church is here. We're blessed that we have a lot of full-time Episcopal Church musicians in this city.
Well, music is just so, it holds a special place in our liturgy and in the way that we pray. Church of the Holy Communion, in December, there's going to be another performance, right? And it's going to be a choral service. Do you want to talk a little bit about the O Antiphons Advent choral service that is coming up? And it's in that 5:30 service, which we, before the break, we were talking about, is typically the time at Church of the Holy Communion where it's a time of worship that is very, it is a time for thinking and a time for just quietness. Talk a little bit about what's coming up in December.
Our Advent choral service is based on what has been known once again from the 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th centuries as the O Antiphons.
Mm-hmm.
These are the verses of the Advent hymn, O Come Emmanuel.
Mm-hmm.
And every verse begins with, O something, O come Emmanuel, O root of Jesse, O key of David. These are all images that can be traced through the prophets of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And in daily worship, in monastic daily worship, they started using these refrains. Antiphon and refrain are the same thing, and it's something that you repeat or you add to a psalm or other piece of music that you're doing. And people have asked me for years in our hymnal, why are all those December dates listed at the beginning of all the stanzas of the hymn, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel?
Mm-hmm.
We just sing the hymn, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel.
Yeah.
But backing up from December 24th, there are individual dates in front of each stanza mm-hmm. of that hymn. And those are the antiphons that the monks would use in daily worship
mm-hmm.
on the days leading up to the birth of Jesus.
Yeah.
So once again,
there's nothing that's a mistake.
Well, no.
Everything is intentional.
And they're tracing the coming of Christ into our world again mm-hmm. and again and again at the Feast of Christmas,
mm-hmm.
just like it was traced through the Old Testament.
Right.
So Peter Halleck, who spent his career at St. Mark's Cathedral in Seattle,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
well known in the Episcopal Church
yes.
and
yes.
around, he wrote anthems, larger works, developed a liturgy that he wrote the music for.
Mm-hmm.
And he called it the O Antiphons. And the liturgy, the service, is based on those O Antiphons. So there are readings. The cantors, who are our soloists,
mm-hmm.
will sing the O Antiphon in the original Latin. And these are texts that we've had to do a little research on and some
yeah.
of the pronunciations of the words because it's the actual Latin
uh-huh.
of the O Antiphon. And then the choir will sing a response to that in English.
Uh-huh.
Our handbell choir is going to accompany these O Antiphons, and the service will include Advent scripture readings. Once again, the scripture readings are going to start with Genesis and trace through Isaiah mm-hmm. and lead up to the birth of Christ.
Right.
And so it's all planned. It's all intentional.
Yes.
It's all telling the story. And we tell the story over and over and over and over because Jesus is present in our lives and is coming again.
Yeah.
This Christmas.
He is. He is. And Advent is such a... It's a time of prayer and waiting with hope.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I love these kind of moments early in the, you know, we, in America, we get so, I think, accustomed to moving our dates and, you know, the moment that last week, you know, Halloween is over and now it's like, okay, well, we're getting in the Christmas spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So we're always having to kind of like jar our own calendars and our, you know, in our own culture, but also within our own spirituality. And I love the opportunity of Advent and the fact that this concert is going to be taking place in December the 3rd. So you can have that Christmassy, if you want to use that word, even though we're like, okay, well, yeah, it's Advent, but we can start. It's a waiting. It's a waiting that comes to its culmination on December the 24th. And the 25th.
I'm happy to hear Christmas carols when I ride up and down the escalator at Dillard's.
Yes.
But you come to a Catholic church or an Episcopal church or a Lutheran church on those four Sundays before Christmas and our traditions are going to make us wait a little bit.
Yeah.
Our traditions are going to back us up and say, Jesus is coming, but is not here yet. And are you prepared?
Yeah.
And that's a gift in itself to make us sit down and reflect and prepare and wait for the coming of Jesus yet again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, David, I'm so grateful for this opportunity to talk to you this morning and just to hear this kind of artwork, this beautiful choral music and the liturgy are, it's a wonderful reminder that it's all alive and well and it's being passed along, that ephemera of music is being passed along. When you, we tend to kind of put a bow on these conversations with the question around what gives you hope, but I feel like it's kind of, I almost want to put words in your mouth. I feel like the hope that you have is just there are people who are finding community in choirs and with music and with these words and phrases that are pieces of the liturgy that change but also stay the same from year to year. What am I right? Or what would you add to that? What else gives you hope in your day-to-day life?
I would absolutely affirm that all of that in our worship tradition in the Episcopal Church gives us hope. And we tell these stories in rhythm and repeat them over and over and over and over. And the caveat to all of that is anybody and everyone are welcomed in the Episcopal Church.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for community, if you're, you know, you want to be a part of something, if you feel like you're alone or whatever, mm-hmm. we have singles, we have singles again.
Yeah.
We have everybody.
Everybody can come.
Is welcomed in the Episcopal Church, and that's something that I celebrate as well.
Amen and agree. Well, thank you, David. Thanks for being you. This is a good start to a Thursday for me.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful for us to get together and chat again. We could have been in my office or your office.
I know. Well, come on down to good old the Diocesan House anytime. You've always got a place. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us today on Faithfully Memphis. You can listen to past episodes of our show on our podcast, and it's on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all those usual places. And if you like what you hear and want to share it with a friend, we are extremely grateful for that. When you share our show or rate it on whatever platform you're listening on, that helps us fall in front of the ears of more people who might like our show. And until next week, I am just praying that you all stay safe and stay positive.